Hey guys, hope you're having a wonderful day out there today. Jamie Hardwick's going to be the guest host on another episode, back by popular demand. The podcast is brought to you by Hardwick.life, which is the website. It's the home of the Lose Like a Lineman program. And if you haven't heard of the program and you're interested in losing weight, get your butt onto the website at Hardwick.life. That's Hardwick.com, but it's Hardwick.life. And if you don't know already, I designed that program 6 years ago for my personal weight loss to get me down from 295. I went all the way down to 202. I lost 85 pounds in under 5 months, and it's given tons of success to a lot of people. And we've just, and you'll hear about this on the podcast with Jamie, we have just redesigned the program, Lose Like a Lineman 2.0, specifically with the female in mind and the female's preferences and what is manageable. So that was with Jamie. She helped me out with that. And she's going through the program right now and having a lot of good success, as you will hear. So check it out at Hardwick.life. Enjoy the show, guys. Hey, guys. Welcome into the Hardwick Life podcast. Joining us today is my former teammate and one of the most electrifying players to ever take an NFL field. It's Sean Merriman. Sean played 8 years in the league, 6 with the Chargers, 2 with the Bills. He was a one-time All-Pro, a 3-time Pro Bowler, the Defensive Rookie of the Year in 2005, the NFL Sack Leader in 2006, a fitness enthusiast, an entrepreneur with business ventures that cover a wide swath of interest. His desire for success and achievement is, along with his work ethic, unmatched. I really marvel at the effort he gives on a daily basis. He's the co-founder of an MMA league, Lights Out XF, owner of Lights Out clothing brand, and host of the Lights Out with Sean Merriman podcast. You can follow him and everything that he's got going on at Sean Merriman. That's S-H-A-W-N-E. Merriman, M-E-R-R-I-M-A-N. He's a great follow, tons of fun. He's got a great social media presence. You guys are going to love this. Yes!
What's up, my man?
What's up, Sean? How are you?
I'm good, man. How you doing?
I am so well. You just sitting in the studio?
Yeah, you know, just knocking out some stuff, man. Zooms, I mean, you name it. I'm just going through my day.
Just another 12-hour day for you.
You know it. You know it, man. I love it. I wouldn't give it up for nothing.
I know. It's funny because it's not work to you. It's just what you do.
Yeah. You know, like people used to say all the time, right? If you do something you love, you never work a day in your life. So when I heard that, I'm like, yeah, people, you know, they're BS, right? They're full of it. But, you know, the truth is that it's when it's fun for you, it's really not work, right? Like some people, you go to some jobs that you just don't want to be at. It's miserable as hell for you. You got to go and deal with people you don't want to deal with. And I find it through my day that I don't deal with anything that I don't want to deal with. So like, that's kind of been the cool situation with me.
Yeah, it's not a job, right? Like there's jobs, there's careers, and this is a career that you have. But it's more than that. It's even more than a career. It's just you. Which is super cool.
You know, one thing, Nick, man, I've always, I wouldn't say really pride myself on. It's something that I kind of live by, right? Because the harder you work, the more stuff you put in, you cross paths when you hit the whole thing, you get lucky and everything happens. Yeah. But people, a lot of times people they're not working when the opportunity's not there. And they only start working when you have opportunity. You get what I'm saying? So if you're working the whole time, like people get crazy opportunities all the time, but they're not ready for them because they wasn't doing what they're supposed to do when the time was out. So me, I just work. I build. And so when the opportunity comes across, I'm like, okay, I'm ready to go. You know, we're done deal. So that's where it's at, man. It's just, you know, it got its ups and downs, right? Because you are like building and, you know, it's a lot of time. And, you know, like this morning I woke up and I'm like, damn, man, I'm a little beat up. I was in San Diego yesterday. Just literally for like 36 hours. And I came back. I just moved up here to Vegas. So yeah, man.
Oh, I didn't know you were in Vegas.
Oh yeah. Yeah.
How is it?
Honestly, you know, San Diego, I'll argue with anybody. It's the greatest place to live in the country, right? I've lived in Miami. I lived in New York, obviously lived in Maryland where I'm from, lived in LA. San Diego is the best place to me, in my opinion, to live in the country. But since I'm never in one spot, it's like, okay, well, what's the next best place? You know, it's inexpensive. I can get in and out of town when I want to. I can go where I need to go. So here I was just automatically, obviously because of the fight game, right? Because the MMA league. So I found myself spending a lot of time here, and I said, man, I can't, you know, flying in, driving up. Let me just go ahead and make that a home base and then travel everywhere else.
Because they got a massive airport, real estate's cheaper, taxes are way lower. Because I know you were in LA, you had the house in San Diego. You still have the house in San Diego?
No, I got rid of it, but I do got a ton of land in Poway. So that's ultimately where I'm going to end up at, man. I got this special place for Poway. I can't tell you why. I mean, I know I lived in Scripps Ranch when I played there, but this special place about Poway, man, I just always envision myself when it's time for me to slow down and be parked somewhere, it's going to be there.
I hear you. I moved back to Indiana. We've been here since the start of quarantine. We didn't move because of quarantine, moved to get closer to family. And we actually sold our house like 5 days before the kids got taken out of school and everything shut down and all that. So it was just kind of the right time. And we got super lucky selling the house at the right time and everything. It all worked out well. And then like when we're recording this, it's April 20th, or yesterday it was April 20th. And it was snowing. I woke up this morning with 3 inches of snow on the ground. I was like, what the hell am I doing here? This is crazy.
I seen that because I got some guys, I got some people that live in the Midwest, and they were sending me pictures and video. And I was like, damn, man. And you know, I'm from the East Coast, so I grew up in the snow.
You know, yeah.
But when you move to the West Coast, dude, you get spoiled. You flat out just get spoiled. So now you go back, you're like, what the hell is this white stuff that's on the ground, right? You just, you're not used to seeing it anymore.
And it was cool for a little bit. Like when I was shoveling snow, when it was probably like 2 weeks over the winter, and I was like, this is cool. It's winter time. This is what we're supposed to do. We're out shoveling. It's a great workout. I enjoy it. It's like, you know, I don't even have to go in the basement and get a lift in or anything. It's like, I got mine. But it's April. And I looked at my wife last night and I was like, there's no way in hell I'm shoveling the driveway. Like it's going to either melt or it's going to stay there, but it's April. There's no way up. Check me out of that.
No, I'm just going to keep my ass in the house. That's about it. So
has Vegas been good to you?
It's been good, man, because, you know, obviously it's grateful fight. I think the UFC has kind of paved the way, for MMA up here. Boxing's always been, you know, big because of Floyd and this is his home, but MMA is really growing up here. I train at Randy Couture's gym out here, Extreme Couture, when I'm here. Yeah. So I train at, you know, 3-4 days, you know, 3 days a week at least, and probably spar at least one or 2 days a week there when I get back going. So, you know, for me, man, it's like I have a pocket where I have a regimen. Like I'm super regimented. I, you know, 6:30 I'm up. I'm this place at 7:30. I'm on the phone by 8:30. I'm in the gym by 9 or 10. You know, so it's, for me, it's like a checklist throughout the day.
How's your body doing? Because I know I see you banging. Like you still get after it. You're still flipping tires. You're still pushing sleds. You still look great. Obviously, it's holding up well. Does it feel all right? You feel good?
So I would say the major problem that I have in my body is like my shoulders, right? Like I have some shoulder pain and stuff. And I don't know if that's obviously from football, because once you go under the knife one time, you're never the same again. Like you're not, you know, it don't go back to like how it was, or it doesn't get better. It just, you're worse. So I had surgery to both my shoulders while I played labrum. And I had a slap, dislocation on this side. So, and I got that when I was in Buffalo. But other than that, man, I still squat, I put 3 plates on it a day. I squat in a day. I still bench, you know, pretty decently heavy. But, you know, when you're doing MMA, you don't need to slam around the weights anymore. Like, I'm over the big weight stage, right?
Yes.
I remember that.
It's more like functional.
It's more functional training. It's band work. It's making sure, you know, pull-ups and, you know, burpees and walking lunges. It's all moving stuff for me. And then it also helps me out doing MMA, right? And the MMA is where I get the cardio and – and I don't have to bang up my knees and trying to run 2 miles, because you can forget it. I mean, running long distance now, just forget about it.
It wrecks you. I can't hardly run. Like I would like to check off on a list, a marathon. I'd like to check off an iron. I can't do it. Like I get up to 10 miles and I'm back on anti-inflammatories and it's just not working for me. And it's not worth it.
Would be a luxury for me if I got that. I mean, you know, if I get up to like two of like just to sit, like It wouldn't be so much my knees, but your knees combination, your lower back. I mean, before you know it, it's
your hips.
Your hips. Now you can't work out like you want to for a couple of days. And I'm like, forget that. So, you know, on the mat in MMA, it actually, I get way more cardio than I need, like upper body and lower. So I actually just, I get everything in that 45 minutes of rolling or whatever we're doing that day.
And you get some of that aggression out. You get that physical content because we're physical beasts. Right? Like we speak a physical language. It's just, it's got to feel good in a way.
It does. I mean, and I always say this because, you know, I don't know if you went through it, but I definitely did. So you got that space, that year or two, right? That it's not there anymore. You're not playing.
That's right.
And so whether it's, you know, depressed, whether it's anxiety, whatever that thing you get from not playing anymore. And I think I went through all of those, even though I had plenty of stuff to do. I was working. I had lights out, clothing, and I was in stores. I mean, I was constantly working, but it just wasn't the same for me. Yeah. So I knew I was missing something. But when I got to doing more boxing, when I got to doing more sparring and rolling around in jiu-jitsu and Muay Thai, it kind of woke that thing back up in me again. And we're so used to being in the locker room. And as you know, Nick, man, you talk to anybody that stopped playing, the first thing I tell you is, hey, I missed the locker room. You miss the guys. That's, I mean, you don't miss the politics. You don't miss the BS. The money's and all that is good. But the first thing that when you normally talk to guys, I miss the locker room. So when I go into these gyms, to these MMA gyms, and there's a lot of shit talking. You know, it's like how we were in the locker. It's just nonstop. You can't come in there with, you know, some tore up jeans on. You can't come in there smelling funky. They're talking about your mom. Talk about. So it's. And the next thing is, hey, put the gloves on. And now we get to going again. So for me, it's kind of been the anchor of my balance to do that, because it takes that competitive edge where I'm not walking around anymore like on like stilts, and I just want to do something. I feel edgy, and I it's almost in a sense of meditation for me for a long time.
Yeah, it gets it out of you. Tell me about, Sean, because you started to touch on it a little bit, the transition out of the game, because I know for me, I had a moment that I can point back to that I was like, well, that was dangerous. That was like that. I was on the edge there. I told my wife and people that listen to the podcast, they'll know, they've heard it before. It's like, I came in, I quit my radio gig. I said, I'm not doing this. This isn't working for me anymore. You can take everything. Leave me $1 million. I'm going to Nicaragua. And that was like everything but saying, hey, I'm going to go kill myself. I'm going to Nicaragua. Cause I couldn't come to that. I just couldn't say that. And she looked at me. She's like, dude, we're going to get you some help. Calm your butt down. And I was like, oh, okay. It was like, she smacked me upside the face. She didn't actually, but figuratively smacked me upside the face. It's like, dude, I need you. These boys need you. You're not going anywhere. What was it like for you? Was it rough?
It was rough, but I think the hardest part for me personally, it was the in-between stage where I retired, but I wasn't sure, you know, if I wanted to go back. I still felt like I could. And so I couldn't really start my second life yet, right? Because you can't go and start building all this stuff and work out and wait for a team to call. Because when I got let go from Buffalo 2 weeks before training camp, just right before my last year, I was just out of it. You know, I knew I was gonna with the Chargers. I knew at some point that was coming. I was just banged up. I was hurt constantly. I knew that was coming. I just didn't know when. Buffalo was in a sense where I signed a 2-year contract and then I was kind of working out, waiting for somebody to call. And so I never in my, you know, at that point, what, 24, 25 years of living, I never had to sit around and wait for anybody. I was like the first one taken. We played the pickup basketball. It was him. We won him. Football and backyard football. I was always the first one taken. So I was always that. And then for that short period of time, I wouldn't get any calls. I said, damn, is this life? Is this real? That I'm sitting around, you know, Pro Bowls and you reach a certain level of stardom and notoriety. Oh, yeah.
Sack leader, defensive MVP as a rookie. I mean, that's, you had a lot going, you had a lot.
And then you're sitting around waiting for a call. So when I finally went back to Buffalo, I think it was like the third or fourth week, and I actually had to, I was running down a scout team. People don't even know, like, I did everything. When I came back, I didn't complain. I didn't do anything. I ran down a scout team, kickoff, wherever they need me at, second string, third, I did everything I could. And then I ended up starting and coming back and coming to myself. But then I wanted to go out on my own terms, right? So I went up to them, and I just had a great game. I had 7-8 tackles and 3 TFLs, and I had a really, really good game. I went up to them and said, look, I'm done. That's it. And I felt more free then than anything else. That was my period where I had, and I felt like, okay, I went out the way I went out. I didn't have to sit around anymore for anybody to call. Yeah. I didn't have to go into the locker room and wonder if this was the day they're going to let me go. And then at that point, I started doing TV stuff. I think I went over to NFL Network first. And then I was doing the Lights Out clothing line. I was working with the M Life Properties, the selling clothes. So I that gave me the sense of like replacing what I was doing.
Yeah.
Right. That was my tough part where I was sitting around, man. I was like, I'll go out to the club and like, I'll get drunk. I'm hungover just so I didn't have to deal with not having a job or waiting for people to, I was literally like, I just couldn't take it.
You didn't have to process all that.
I didn't have to do it anymore. I was worried more about having a hangover than I was, you know, somebody calling me. I was like, you know, damn, you know, hell with this. I'm like, I'm gonna go out and have fun and just not think about it. So that was the point for me where I had that moment.
Do you think you told them in Buffalo, I'm done after the good game? I'm on a high note here as a self-protective mechanism. So you couldn't get hurt.
100%. And more importantly, not even getting hurt is just that, you know, because I always, and what I think we said, the eye in the sky don't lie, right? And so, you know, I went through that period where I was hurt and I was hobbling around on one Achilles, the AFC Championship game. I got two major ligaments torn. We all kind of walked into that game banged up. But
it's funny. I forget because there's so many, right? There were so many injuries. Gates had his, Phillip had his, I had the Liz Frank, you had LT had his. I mean, it was Jamal, I think, had to have surgery after that game. We were a mess.
Yeah, we were all beat up. And so for me to go out that way where somebody can turn on the field, and I still, like years later, talk to the coaches after, and they were always in a general manager, and they would look at that game and say, man, you could have came back and played. I said, I know. You know, so that was kind of my way of being done with it on my terms.
And you got to control the situation. Right. And that was a huge turning point going back to that season. And I think it was the Tennessee game, right? It was Mawai and Stewart or Mawai and Roos. And I forget what that was, but that was the game that really, I mean, you tore your PCL. Did you tear your MCL in that?
Yeah, I tore my PCL and LCL. And so, you know, it's funny because I've been, you know, because where I grew up at, we grew up, I was homeless several times, and we grew up with jack shit, right? We grew up with nothing. And so I was always told to not complain about the circumstances, no matter what. You know, you're going to be dealt with some bad cards in life, but not to complain. I never complained in my life about anything. And so the real story and what happened in kind of the Tennessee game is I ended up running into Vince Young's. He was doing a rollout, right?
Yeah.
And I ran into him. Now, the tackle was still blocking me. It wasn't like it was no tackle, and I just ran upfield and hit him. He was still blocking me, so I'm thinking I got a sack, right? So I finally pulled up when I see he didn't have the ball, and he ended up cracking or fracturing his ribs. Well, Jeff Fisher came over, and I saw him. And mind you, I know Vince Young. I think we had the same PR at the time, and we've met several times and hung out. And so I'm kneeling down because I'm feeling – and I'm on top of him like, hey, dude, oh, my God, you cool? You good? You cool? And he was just in excruciating pain or whatever. I'm like, damn. So I came back, walked to the huddle. Jeff Fisher walked out. He's also kneeling over Vince Young, but he's looking at me dead in the eyes like I did it on purpose. And I'm like, this is my boy. What are you talking about? Why would I do that? It doesn't make any sense, right? So the very next play, they ran in motion. They took the tight end in motion and blasted me, blindsided me on the line of scrimmage.
Yeah.
A little toss crack. And they actually got a penalty on that play. So, and I got up. Went back or whatever, but it was the very next play where Stewart and Kevin Mawai, 15, 20 yards away, had jumped on my knee, right? Yeah. Now, initially, they didn't. I don't believe that they were trying to hurt me, but they were definitely trying to do something to me in retaliation when thinking I did something to Vince.
Yeah.
But in that play, I tore my knee. I heard a tear. I mean, I heard a pop. It wasn't, you know, as soon as it happened, I didn't think something was wrong. I knew something was wrong.
You knew, yeah.
And you know, I was always taught since a kid never to lay on the field, right? Because I didn't want to be the one. I just, you know, we see these young guys now, they land on the field and they got shoulder issues. I'm like, dude, what's wrong with your legs?
Get up.
Like, it's your shoulder. What are you laying on the field for? And so I never wanted anyone to see me laying on the field. So I kind of walked back to the sideline and my knee is just all over. You know, it's moving back and forth, yeah. and I, you know, just all over the place. And so I went back in and tried to put my foot in the ground. It just wouldn't happen. After the game, you know, the reporters came to me and I still really didn't say much. So fast forward, right? It ultimately changed the course of everything that I was doing. I was on pace. Even that year, I did finish, I think, with 12 or 13 sacks. I probably, if I was healthy, maybe finished with 17 again, because I was just on that kind of a run.
Oh, yeah.
And fast forward. So I got this thing against Kevin Mawai. I said, if I see this dude, I'm going to crack him right in the mouth, right? Wherever I see him for years. I said, if I see him, it's on site right away. I'm punching this dude in the face. And a couple years ago in Canton at the Hall of Fame, I was with Ray Lewis. Ray Lewis invited me out. I actually was in Ray Lewis's room when they knocked on the door for his Hall of Fame. I was with him and his family. And I ran into Kevin Mawai in downstairs by the elevator. So I'm all squared up. I don't care.
You're ready to go.
I'm ready to go. I don't care if I get arrested. I don't give a shit about nothing. Right. Cause that was the only way I can redeem. I can't play against him anymore. So the only way I can do him is kind of kick this dude's ass. And he walked up, and as he walking up to me, he had tears in his eyes and said, I'm so sorry. I didn't mean to do that. And I mean, he was, you know, kind of talking to me and trying to get it out there. And at that moment, I kind of dropped my guard because I was all squared up to go. I was going to jump on this dude in the lobby downstairs. And by the time he walked up to me, he had tears in his eyes. And he said that wasn't his intentions. And he apologized and asked me, did I accept his apology? And he put his hand up and I shook his hand. And I said, I accept. I appreciate it. Thanks for apologizing. And that was it.
Wow. And you've genuinely accepted, like, wow. Yeah. Because I mean, you want to talk about changing things, right? Like, you were one of the ultimate lions that ever came in the NFL. I mean, on path to be right there, getting your door knocked on for the Hall of Fame. Right. And to be able to let that go, it's massive. Right. It's massive.
And you know, the only time I do even feel a little bit about something. Right. So, for example, I went to I went to NFL Network when I retired and I was there. Mm-hmm. So, you know, you up there with Deion Sanders and Marshall Faulk, Michael Irvin, and everybody up there got either Super Bowl rings or they got a jacket. Right. Terrell Davis, you know, he just got his, you know, a jacket. So,
LT.
You know, and LT. So I'm sitting there. I'm like, damn, man, I'm never going to get a jacket. And for me, when you come into it and kind of selfishly, you want to be considered the best at what you do. And, you know, having that jacket makes you the best at what you did. Right. So that's the only time that I would feel at uneasy about the situation. But even that, so now, man, it's like, you know, I get the respect as a guy who, you know, was supposed to be in the Hall of Fame and other people I played with or played against. So that part of it means a lot. But yeah, you still had those times, man. It was like, damn, you know, if I had two more healthy seasons, I probably would have had an opportunity.
Oh, yeah. And I mean, coming from a former teammate, a guy who got to strap on the helmet and the shoes with you, that watching you on the field, you're in that class, right? There's very few people who came and changed the dynamic of, we were trending upwards, but when you came in, it changed the dynamic of the locker room. And I said it in the introduction, I'm like, he's one of the most electrifying players to ever step on any NFL field. And you were, and I mean, everything about it, right? Like when we would be rolling or we'd be closing out a game, and very rarely can you go, well, who's going to make the play? Well, we knew who was going to make the play. We knew it was going to be you jumping on somebody's back. And like, actually, that's why I say you're lying, because you just would jump on Peyton Manning's back and rake him down like a freaking lion. And it was unbelievable. And then the crowd would, I thought this was one of the coolest things. It's like, I always said, I would either want to be a rock star or do the job that I did, but the job that I did wasn't as cool as the job that you did, because you had the power of a rock star when you would hit the dance, and the place would just go. And I got goosebumps as I'm talking through it. It's like Qualcomm would just go bananas. Like, it was unbelievable. The roof, if there was a roof on there, it wouldn't have existed anymore. It would have been up in Mars. Like, what did that feel like when you set that off?
You know, so my freshman year in high school, I went to Frederick Douglass and up in Marlboro, Maryland. My high school coaches, they told me that if you want to see a real linebacker play, we're going to take you to see one. And so they took me to a Ravens game. And this was in 2000. And we didn't have much. We didn't have anything. We didn't have any money. So we sat up literally three seats down from the light bulb. Right, I could have reached behind and like grabbed the light bulbs and changed the damn light bulbs. That's how high we were. So this was in 2000. Ravens was super hot. Remember that team they had? And Peter Boulware, and I mean, just they were just loaded with everybody, right? And they were doing introductions. And so Peter Boulware came out, and all these other great stars too on that team. That was, you know, they had stars galore, but I ain't never seen nothing like this. They called Ray Lewis last, and this music stopped. The smoke came out, fireworks, everything got quiet, and all I heard is "It's getting hot in here." Nelly came on, and Ray came out, and so I used to watch the replays of the concerts with Michael Jackson and stuff, right? Where these people like faint, you hear them, see them sweating, they just pass out, right? And in the audience. And yep. I always say, man, what the hell is wrong with these people? He's a person. Like, it's only Michael Jackson. I get it. He's Michael Jackson, but he's a person. And so I always thought it was ridiculous, right? And when they did that and they played the music and it's getting hot. And when I felt like I was going to pass out because I was screaming. I literally felt. So that moment, I started thinking about those people at the Michael Jackson concert. And I was like, you know what? I'm going to make people, you know, feel this way about me one day. And I told my high school coaches that. I looked to them after the smoke cleared and they was started to get into the game announcements. I told my high school coaches, I said, man, I'm going to get somebody to do that with me one day. And that's kind of would, you know, kind of triggered everything. And then Ray obviously became a like older brother and a mentor of mine.
When'd you guys meet? How'd you guys become so close?
Well, his brother, Keon Lattimore, played running back at the University of Maryland. And so we got really close then. And so I was around, man, I was around like that life, right? I mean, I've seen so much as a kid, practically a kid, and to have that knowledge from somebody who's been doing it and at that level, right? So it's not like, you know, some guy that was kind of trying to make the team and, oh, you got an NFL. No, you had the best of the best. And yeah. I was talking to Ray, and even in NFL, me and Ray would talk almost every night before the game. After we finished our team meetings and I got back to my hotel, to the room, before, you know, Dick Lewis came and knocked on everybody's door, I was on the phone with Ray. And sometimes all we would do is just talk about what we planned on doing. And Ray would get me so high because, you know, Ray can motivate a flea, right? Yeah. I mean, he can make anybody go. And he would say, let me tell you something here, Shay. You all call me Shay. Shay, let me tell you something. I'm going to run through somebody's soul tomorrow. And I'll get to going. A couple of times I had to hang up on him because he'd get me so hyped up and I can't sleep, right?
That's like, I got to go to bed, Ray.
So he said, what you plan? I said, man, I'm going to get a sack or two tomorrow. We probably blow these boys out by, you know, a couple of touchdowns. I'm going to get off tomorrow. I'm going to do my thing. And then he said, oh, yeah, I'm sideline to sideline, Shay. When I see him, I ain't tackling. I'm running through their soul. And I say, all right, Ray, I think I got to get off the phone now, right? Because you get so hyped up, but it literally was that. And then, so, you know, I'll go back after the game, I'll see what he did, you know, see how the team did, see how he played. He'll be watching, be like, man, that, you know, he's sitting there with his kids and they watch me do the lights out dance on ESPN or Sports Center, wherever they showed it. And so that's how, you know, our relationship went practically my whole career.
So the little Ray Lewis story, you know, he varied in weight. Like over the years, like one year he'd show up and be about 235. And then one year he would be about 260 and just thick. And it just kind of depended on what they were going to ask him to do. And if they were going to ask him to hunker down and take him out on third down, he was going to get big. I ran into him once when he was about 260 and it was the heaviest chest that I'd ever put my face mask in. And I blocked him, but it was like, daggone, that'll shorten your neck up. He was just so thick and so dense and knew how to hit. Man, he was. And I tell you, that Ravens linebacker core, I mean, you could even throw in the front too. That was an intimidating bunch now. They were stacked. Like, they were just physically and just the looks they had on their faces.
And their mentality, man. I mean, they had, yeah. And I'm, you know, I'm sure you probably talk about including Suggs, but then they, one year, I think they had a few other guys too. When they were just, yeah, they were stacked.
Yeah, even some of their backup linebackers were just like long-armed and jacked and nasty. I mean, they played nasty. Like, you wouldn't remember their names necessarily, but they were kind of like us, where people wouldn't maybe remember Coop because of everybody else's names. But when you played him, you knew him.
You knew exactly who he was. And that's another thing, too. And Ray kind of put this into me early on, because he said, look, anybody can go out and have a great game, but can you make everybody else have a great game? And I remember him telling me this my sophomore year when I was at University of Maryland. And so, you know, he kind of told me the importance of lighting the fire out of everybody else. And I don't know if you remember DeQuincy, DeQuincy Scott. DeQuincy Scott, right?
Yeah.
So he was the guy, he broke down a team, right? Broke down the team before every game. He was the guy. I mean, DeQuincy was great. But, you know, Ray asked me, like, in the training camp, he said, who's breaking down the team? He said, is it you? I said, no, man, I'm not even starting or anything, because, you know, Ben Lieber. He said, nobody break down the team but you. That's what you do. I say, all right, you know. So I'm like, you know, I'm still like the big brother. Yeah, yeah, whatever you say. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, got you, Ray.
Yeah, got you. And then DeQuincy had, I think he had hurt his quad. He had a quad or thigh bruise or something around that time. And then that's when I kind of stepped up and did that and carried that role throughout, man. So he played, you know, really intricate part in like everything that I really did, because especially when it came to football wise, he had so much knowledge, man. It was just like endless amount of just knowledge.
It's funny, because I was going to ask you, I was like, what gave you the gall as a rookie coming in to own that huddle, right? Like, you see the dudes that are around. Steve Foley's there. Ben Lieber's there. Jamal's there. Quentin's there. Terrence. It's like, I mean, there's some dudes now. And you come in as a rookie, 20-something years old, spring chicken. And it's like, this is my team.
Yeah. I just turned 21 in May. You know, we got drafted in April, and I just turned 21 in May. It was less of an age thing or year thing. It's more of a mentality thing, right? Mm-hmm. And when you look back on it, and I laugh now, because we had a great locker room across the board. And then you really don't understand or don't kick in how many stars, right? I mean, it's just like bona fide superstars that we had in one locker room until you get away from the game, right? Because when you're in it, everybody's brothers, we're family, we're teammates, right? And you're seeing each other every day. But I do, man. I sit back, you know, sometimes like, damn, I played in there with Antonio Gates. You know, Phillip Rivers, LT, right? Neal, are you kidding me? These are, you know, guys who will all have jackets one day and all be known for the next 50 years.
On your side, Steve Foley, Randall Godfrey, Donnie Edwards. I mean, crazy. Some guys that we missed, Luis Castillo, Igor. Think about that defense, though. Think about that. That our defense, especially when we were young, you guys were the deal now.
You know, we just had a even Coop, man, and how he stepped in there when Randall went down, you know, was gone. And this is a guy that was, you know, a free agent. He didn't get drafted.
Out of Maine,
right? Who the hell? You know,
they don't even play ball in Maine.
Right, and I still tell people, I said, Stephen Cooper's probably the smartest defensive player I've ever played with. He knew everything. I think for me, it was just more of a mentality on where I envision myself and being in that starting role and whatever. And somebody asked me the other day, because I brought up Ben Lieber's name, but I learned a lot of, because I sit back and I watch, man. I know I talk trash and everybody, oh, this dude cocky, but I watch a lot of people and I watch Ben. And one thing I learned from Lieber, that he was so disciplined. He was so disciplined and so smart that if he was supposed to be in the gap, he was going to be there. And that was the gift and the curse and why they even drafted me, right? Because he's going to do his job, but he wasn't going to, hey, look, if you got to go under this block to go get that sack, you got, you know. So it was right. A gift and a curse. So I did learn a lot of things like, okay, on this play, you got to be here because that mic has to roll over and protect your outside, right? So I knew kind of where to go and do certain things, but I learned a lot from Ben Lieber sitting back there.
Yeah, learning when it's your time to make a play, when it's somebody else's time to make a play. And then, hey, like I said, when I'm sitting on the sidelines, we need a play. You also know that. You know that it's your time. Marty passed away earlier this year. What did Marty give you? He gave me a lot, kind of reluctantly, because, you know, I was a brash punk that headbutted guys on the field and drew flags, and I think I drew his ire a lot. But he gave me a lot of that one play at a time mentality that I still, every day, I still do that same thing. One play at a time, man. What did he give you?
For me, so when I came in, so one of the first things that happened, I think the first time he actually had a real conversation with me outside of the draft day when he kind of sat down or whatever, and we just got our pads on that day, and I went 1-on-1 with Lo'Neal, and that day I blew Lo'Neal up. Even I wasn't supposed to, you know, I ran right through Lo'Neal, and I was supposed to be pass rushing, right? And I made the crowd go and whatever, and he came over and like, man, I love this, right? So I knew that he liked to play, like the attitude. I knew he loved that stuff or whatever. But this is one thing that always stuck with me, and even now to this day. So my rookie year, we're playing the Kansas City Chiefs, and I'm at linebacker, not on the line of scrimmage. They moved me back into the linebacker role because it was a weak side, and you know, we came back, and Priest Holmes, they pitched to hit a sweep to the right side. So I'm flying and I'm haul ass into the other side. And I saw that SP had made him cut back. And I said in my head during the play, I said, if he cut back at the right time in the right place and I'm there, he's going to sleep. And I'm thinking that in my head, I was like, this dude, he's going to sleep because I'm haul assing as fast as I possibly could. And he cut back and I, boom, leveled him, knocked him out. Right. So I'm sitting there and I'm celebrating. I'm, you know, SP celebrating. I'm celebrating. I'm jump up, down, screaming. And Priest is out, right? So I looked at him, and his eyes are kind of rolled back in his head, and he was still holding on to the football, but his hands were, like, twitching. And so even at that time, it never clicked to me on how scary that was, because I was just still – I was pumped up. I was screaming. You know, I'm not
– Yeah, you were making a play.
I was making a play. So I got on the sidelines, and I'm still celebrating. I'm hooping and hollering. I'm going crazy. And Marty Schottenheimer grabbed me by the face mask. He said, Sean – great hit, but don't forget that this guy's family and his friends are watching. And so for me in that moment, it kind of told me a lot about who he was, right? He was tough as nails. He'll come down on you. He'll line you up. He's hard on you. He'll line you up in Oklahoma drills. And next day come in, you know, pat you in the back, and he'll line you up in the Oklahoma drills again. But at that moment, I calmed down. I settled down like, damn, he's right. You know, Priest Holmes was out for almost two commercial breaks. He was still down. Yeah. And that, you know, that was Marty, man. And he always kind of played like this, like a father figure or somebody who you knew that cared about you far greater than what you did on the football field. And then if you went even hard and you had attitude, which he loved even more. And so that was just, you know, what I remember most about him. And one thing that I struggle with and almost I kind of teared up during LT's his Hall of Fame speech. And I was out there for that weekend or those few days.
Yeah.
And this was I want to say 16 or 17. I forgot exactly which year it was. But Marty was there, and, you know, his wife was there, Ms. Schottenheimer, and they were all there. And you go up to Marty and he'll remember you, right? So he asked about my mom, because at one point me and my mom had a really, really rocky relationship, and he knew about my family. And then an hour later, even 30 minutes later, you go up to him and he don't remember nothing of who you were.
Oh.
And so when he didn't remember who I was at the time, I kind of remember walking away a little bit, and I caught myself like tearing up as I was walking away. And that shit really, for me, it hit me hard. And I didn't know how bad, you know, once you stop playing or you're not there, you don't know how bad his condition is or how he's doing. I know he went back to his home in North Carolina around his family and stuff. So I didn't know how bad things were. So I went up, had a conversation with him. And he'll ask me about my mom and everything else. And then 30 minutes, I walked up and he had no idea on who I was.
Yeah, it's tragic. And he was such a really interesting dichotomy because he did have both sides where he was so fierce and he understood what it took to win at the highest level. And he understood how violent and brutal the game is and it's necessary to be. But at the same time, he was the guy that, and you said the Kansas City Chiefs, he would bring up Derek Thomas all the time. And he'd always tear up talking about Derek Thomas and how special of a man he was and how special of a player he was. And every single time he would tear up, but it was not uncommon to see Marty get really vulnerable with the team. I mean, almost there were moments where you're like, Jesus, not again, Marty. But
you remember the bets we had in the team meeting room. I want a lot of money off of Marty because we had that over under a minute going, right? We had the over whether he was going to cry or not.
So
I remember, you know, everybody had 20s under there. Everybody whipped out a 20, 50, whatever you were betting. And everybody had it under the chair, kind of holding it in their hand and waiting for that minute to happen, whether he was going to tear up or that bottom lip, you know, get to trembling. Whenever.
Oh, yeah.
Trembling, you know, it's coming.
Start having the hands in the pocket and turn around and...
I think the funniest part was, is when he finally found out that we were betting on him, I remember one time he was like in the middle of tearing up and he said, I know your asses are betting on me crying, but you know, I don't give a damn. Right. And, so yeah, man, I just, you know, I miss him, just miss him a lot.
Yeah. Yeah. He taught so much. And I've always told people my favorite coaches in retrospect, the best ones that I had were the ones that were at the time, the ones that I didn't like, that the ones that pushed me harder than I wanted to be pushed and made you uncomfortable and challenged you and took that rebel out of me, which I'm thankful for because it did allow me to have a long, fruitful career. So I'm super grateful for that. Tell me about, give me a little bit about, because you talked about your mom and homeless growing up. It's funny because as teammates, right? Like we have so many good memories together, but then there's so many teammates that I wish I knew more about. Like I wish I knew more about you and where you came from. And I think you could say that about most teams and most teammates is like, we know each other and I would do anything for you. And I know you'd do anything for me. And I could like with the guys that I played with, like all you had to do was grunt and I'm there. Like that's it. One look in the eye and it's on, we'll go. But then you wish you knew a little bit more about a teammate, right? It's like, give me a little bit. Like what was it like as a kid?
You know, Nick, I think that for that reason, because we all talk about mental health and stuff now, right? We really talk about these things because when, you know, I grew up in a time and in an area and an era where, you know, you got punched in your chest for crying, right? Or you got spanked or you got put in a corner or whatever that was for you know, being whatever, right? And so even when we were playing and we all making a ton of money, we all got our own thing going on. Some guys got family, some guys will go out more and be out more like myself, right? With me, you know, me Cooping SP will be in the streets. And so what we always missed is the other personal aspect of when we left the locker room, right? Or what somebody maybe dealing with or have dealt with. And for me, I've always kind of hid that and never talked about it because it was weak for me. You know, I've always had a rocky relationship with my mom for a long time. And when I didn't talk too much about growing up homeless, or whatever, because I didn't want to be like, another rags to riches story or, you know, another athlete that's come from the ghetto or come from the hood or whatever that is looking for some to promote itself. Like I just didn't want to. So for me, I think it was more of a image and a self-conscious, like not even really knowing that I was doing it, more of like, hey, I'm tough, don't mess with me type of deal.
Yes.
Or coming across as cocky or arrogant because I always had to fight and protect everything where I came from and grew up. And I'll, you know, give you an example. I mean, my mother couldn't pay the light and electricity bill where we lived at. So, she had lit a candle, right? And the candle, I ended up leaving and going to stay with a friend because they had lights and they had food and they had electricity. So I went to go stay a couple blocks down the street. And anyway, that candle that my mom lit had burned through the TV and burned our place down, right? And so I got a call like in 4 or 5 o'clock in the morning. I got there and like half of the our place was like charcoal on the right side. It was done. So anyway, we went to go, we lived in a motel, ate for a little bit, and then we ended up going to a shelter because we couldn't even afford to live there anymore. And so I just remember in the middle of the night, and you tie your shoes and stuff on the twin beds wherever you stand because people come and it'll steal your stuff, right? So you tie a tight knot. And so I remember, you know, I heard my shoes rattling and I looked down, somebody's trying to take my shoes. So I remember just punching them and decking this dude. And had somebody else with me, I don't know who they were, and getting my shoes. So I've always grown up with this thing, like, hey, you're not taking what's mine and I'll fight you for it. And that was the attitude, right? And I grew up in PG County, Prince George's County area and Washington DC area. And this is when the crack epidemic in the 80s and 90s it started really in Washington DC. It was the first place it hit in the country. So I grew through that era. That's the era that I grew up in. So you find yourself being tough, protective, not showing any weakness, and it comes across and it rubs people the wrong way because they have no idea why you're acting like this. And so, and it's funny, me and my sister, I got two younger sisters, but me and my middle sisters, we're really close because we're close in age. We just started talking about this stuff when we were almost 30 years old apiece. Yeah. We joked about it sometime on how bad we used to have it, or our lights being cut off, was not having food, or our mom like making us go get the leftover food we threw in the trash can out because said, you're not going to waste any food around this house. So we joked about it, but we didn't really have a conversation about it until we were almost like 30 plus years old. You know, I remember the day we talked about it. I had a 4-year-old son. My son's 11 now, but he was 4 at the time. I had a 4-year-old son before we talked about any kind of childhood trauma or whatever we dealt with. So I'm not surprised that all of us didn't talk about that more because, you know, the money masked a lot of problems that you had. The competitiveness and the physical stature that we carried around masked a lot of those issues and problems. So I'm not surprised that, you know, you didn't know more about me when it comes to that, because it was lights out. It was this image and this thing that I put up to protect that side. So I'm not surprised about that at all.
Oh man, that is awesome. And you know, I completely understand all of that. And I also, you know, those stories are super important, and you probably know that now. Like, those stories to kids that come from where you come from, that's important to hear, that I can achieve. I can be something. I just have to go do it, and I have to be tenacious, and I have to have this work ethic. And, you know, it's funny, like you say, masking who you are and where you come from. I come from the other end of the spectrum. Like, I've got green arms, dude. This is a protective mechanism too. Like, all these tattoos, that's so nobody fucks with me, right? That's because I came from suburban Indianapolis, Indiana, as just like a super middle-class white dude walking into a tenacious locker room. And it's like, I didn't play football in high school. I didn't know what the hell was going on. And these dudes, like, everyone was scary to me, right? So it's like, what do I do? It's like, before you go to prison, you have somebody kick your ass, so you just get all ugly. It's like, go maul yourself up and get nasty looking. I remember being on the field once in Denver, and somebody's like, man, we ain't scared of you and your green tattoos. And I was like, they said, where are you from? And I was like, I was from Shreveport, Louisiana. I was like, I'm from the port. And I was like, I have no idea where it came from. I was like, I'm from the port. And he was like, oh man, he's from the port. He's like, leave him alone. I was like, I don't even know what Shreveport's like. I don't know if it's rough. I don't know what's going on out there, but I do. I completely understand, because we're in a place where it really is a physical hierarchy, where there's an alpha and there's an order below that. And everybody understands that order. And it's very natural to understand that order in the locker room. And if you do show weakness, and if you do get vulnerable, and you stand in front of the room and it's like, hey, here's where I'm from, and it's funny now because coaches would do this. They would urge this. I talked to a guy the other day who played for Lou Holtz at South Carolina, and he said Lou would make us stand in front of the room and share our stories because he knew that connecting was going to bring us closer together. And by bringing us closer together, we're going to care more, we're going to do more, we're going to work harder, and we're going to have a better team. So when I look back, it's like, I understand why we did what we did because football was status quo, but new science would tell you, it's like, you should probably share your stories a little bit more and get to know one another and be vulnerable and open up. That way we can make these connections. It's like, damn, dude, I had no idea. And that's how I feel about your story. I had no idea.
Yeah. Well, you know what, Nick, man, to be honest, you know, I got my son's 11 now. My dad wasn't around when I grew up. So you learn how to fend for yourself, right? Cause you don't have adult male figure and stuff. Like, you know, one of my son's coaches or somebody around the neighborhood is, you know, some parent or something, give my son some shit. I'm like, call him. I'm like, oh, hey, what's the deal? Right. What you tell me what's going on. Well, why, you know, why isn't my kid? So I had nobody there to really fend for me. So I've always had to do it myself. And through that, you build up this callus of being a certain way. And you don't know that until you get out of it. And it makes it okay to realize that that's the deal. And, you know, my son is growing up in Monroe, New Jersey. You know, it's a, you know, upper middle class, like nice neighborhood. And, you know, Danny DeVito lives like quarter mile down the street. You know, like he lives a nice life, and I'm happy for that because he's not going to have to ever put up a facade. You know, he got somebody that always got him, no matter what. And I don't really regret that part of it. I think it actually made, you know, because I got this funny theory, right? Look at anybody who is the top of the industry, and I don't care whether you're talking to Microsoft. Look at any big CEO or any owner, everybody's had something happen where they're a little bit different, right? Well, I don't care if it's childhood trauma. I don't care if it's something. And for a long time, I was like, man, I'm different. And I don't know why I'm acting like this. And I don't know why. And so, you know, even now with the stuff that I'm doing, you got to have a lot of balls, man. I mean, you know, to go out on your own and grow a league and do all this stuff. And you have done it from scratch. And I've built stuff from scratch, and you have to be a little bit off to get there, because a lot of people tell you like, hey man, you know, put that money to the side. Don't go balls to the walls in this name because you can lose it all. And I'm like, let's do it. You know, let's do it.
Cool.
Let's do it. So yeah. I am thankful because, you know, though it might come across to, you know, someone else as crazy or being a certain way, I'm thankful that I'm crazy enough to do it. Because a lot of people aren't crazy enough to do it. They play it safe and they're scared to take that next level or take that you know, that step off the ledge and say, hey man, whatever happens, but I'm doing it. So it did work out in my favor.
Yeah, and that's you. That's how you can come in and own the huddle as a rookie. That's how you can come in and change the dynamic of a locker room. You change the temperature of the place wherever you are. You're coming in and people are going, what's that dude doing? Cool. Yeah, it making noise, and it's in a good way. And the podcast is tremendous, and I love what you're doing with it. So great. All right, coming up on it here. When I heard the news, not kidding, like it floored me. Like I fell down to the ground and I wept when I heard that Vincent passed. And for people listening, that Vincent Jackson, when he passed a couple of months ago, it floored me. It dropped me to the ground, and I broke down like I was boohooing, and it was tragic, right? Like how did I, and I don't even know if I've completely processed all of it. Like how have you dealt with it? How have you processed this?
Well, I found out about it. Somebody sent me a Twitter link.
That's how I got it too.
Yeah. And I didn't even really pay attention to it. It was a TMZ Twitter, right? Didn't pay attention to it. I looked at it and, you know, I get a bunch of texts or whatever. So I didn't open it. I'm like, got my headphones on and whatever. So I finally like sat down, almost done my workout between my sets, and I opened it. And I literally had, I looked at my phone, I looked at it closer, and I was like, yeah, right. So, you know, no way, right? And
same thing.
Yep. I've had, you know, really close people to pass away, and I believed it right away. You know, I was like, oh hell, But it just didn't make any sense. It didn't make any sense. So I literally got up, I walked out the gym, and I called a few people. And then I talked to Arthur Hightower, right? You know, our head of player development. Player development. When we were there, and I said, "Yo, is this true? Is it real?" He said, "Yeah, man." He had a very low tone voice and sounded like that. You know, he was floored too. And I just, you started to think, man, and I, just the conversation we just had right now, right? What the hell? Like, if something else is going on and we never talked about anything, and you know, like I said, man, we're forced to walk around with, you know, the big chest, right? We're forced to walk around with all this stuff and not show, because in how we grew up and or the time and era and what we were doing, is just, that wasn't a good thing. So I was floored, man. And I just could not believe it. And then the other little stuff started to come out. What was he doing in the hotel? Right. What was he like, all this? And I started, I started to kind of put everything like two and two together. Like I still don't know all the details, but you start to put together enough where you're like, okay, all right, you know, maybe this happened.
Right.
So yeah, man, just like you, it hurt me. It hurt bad. And it was something I just, it was so off guard, that I couldn't even process what had just happened.
Because from all accounts, and the last time I saw him and the last time I talked to him, which wasn't too long before that, everything was great. Like, businesses were going super well. He's got a young kid, he's got an amazing wife, and everything seemed to be like, he had the keys to Tampa Bay. Like, he was basically like the assistant mayor. I mean, and then all of a sudden it's really hard to fathom. So tragic. Lights, I know you're a busy man. I appreciate this hour. I really appreciate it. It's funny, after all these years that we've known each other, I appreciated getting to know you.
No, same here, man. And you know, like I always say this, sometimes we're the closest to people that we don't see and talk to as much, right? Mm-hmm. Some of my closest friends, we don't get a chance to see each other that often, and we don't talk a whole lot because we watch each other from a distance. We are like that hustle, that grind, there's always a connection there. So when I see, you know, you, and then what you're doing on the health tip and working out, man, like all that stuff, even I've even taken some of the recipes, you know, and I'm like following some of the programs, like, cause you know, I'm always been a glutton for information. So I like, if, okay, somebody, I can cut, you know, 5 pounds here in the midst. Okay, cool. I'm gonna start eating this or doing that.
Yep.
So, you know, just seeing it from a distance, man, it's been cool and get a chance to, you know, really talk to you guys and stay connected in a way. So I'm always here, dude. If you ever needed me, be there in 2 seconds.
Thank you, buddy. Hey, I appreciate this. I respect the hell out of you. I love you, man. Thank you.
Love you too, brother. Appreciate you.
All right, Sean. Bye-bye.
Okay, you got it.